Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear. Coming up this hour.
As you can see in the painting, there's a bulldozer right next to it, and it was about to be torn down. And that's really pretty typical of her approach to capturing what's happening in the city. Sometimes the bulldozer was about to come, sometimes it's actually in the picture.
The D.C. artist who captured a changing city in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But first, we'll meet a man who's witnessed some major history, even making some of that history himself, as the first African-American varsity sports coach in Montgomery County, Maryland. Warren Crutchfield, or Crutch as he's known, lives on the same land his ancestors bought after being freed from slavery after the Civil War.
All right, here we are at 20 Martin's Lane.
Wooden sign outside says the Crutchfields. On this property north of Rockville's town center, you'll find the house Crutch shares with his wife, a two-story structure his great-great-grandfather originally built. You'll also find a cemetery where generations of family members have been laid to rest. But the day I visit what Crutch affectionately calls the home place...
Hello, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
The 79-year-old Montgomery County native...
Come on in.
Is more or less homebound, recovering from a leg injury.
Out there, we have a historical cemetery, and I was cleaning it up, and I had a chainsaw, and the chainsaw said, zip.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I cut it with the chainsaw, and then I drove myself to the hospital. And my family, oh my God, you could hear them yelling all over the place. You did what? You did what? Oh, my God. Yeah.
But here's the thing. Something Crutch has learned in his 79 years.
You know, your things happen. You can't do it. You gotta work with it.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, you have to work with it. You have to, yeah.
Warren Crutchfield started working with it in a whole different era, back when Montgomery County was segregated.
Back then, the only thing that the black kids could do, they could be a teacher or a preacher, and there was very few doctors. I didn't see any of those things, you know, that I could relate to that I wanted to be.
Crutch got decent grades and did well as a sprinter at the county's only secondary school for black students, Carver High.
But we didn't have a coach. And if you walk out there, they don't have a track. You just run around the field.
Now, his dad had told him if he didn't go to college, he had to join the military.
He said, you got two things you can do. You can go to college or you can go to service.
So Crutch applied to a bunch of historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs.
You only could go to historical black colleges, like Howard University, Morgan State, Spelman.
He decided on West Virginia State, but it wasn't a good match. So he came back and worked for a white woman at the local department store chain Woodward and Lothrop.
Yeah. Woody's.
Yeah, Woody's, yeah. Okay, so the only thing that a black person could do could be a porter. So you had a dustpan, and you sweep up stuff around the stuff, you know, and I'm doing all that. So the lady came up to me. She said, Warren? I said, yes. She said, do you know what you have? I said, no. She said, you have a gift, and I'm firing you. I got fired from Woody's because this lady said, you're not working here. She said, you have more on the ball than being a porter, you know, sweeping the floor.
So Crutch gave college another try, this time going to the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and running track.
And that's when I blossomed because I had a coach. I had a coach.
Crutch would go on to become a world-class sprinter, eventually attending the Olympic trials, though he missed qualifying for the 100 meters by 0.1 seconds. But he found his true love in teaching. After college, he was hired as a traveling physical education teacher in Montgomery County elementary schools as they began to integrate.
The irony is, I'm a black guy, and they gave me the curriculum, and they said, you got T-square dance. I said, what? In the black college, they have no square dance. I had to get the records. Alaman, right? Don't you know, do your partner. Go to the... But I had a ball. I had a ball with those kids.
He also had his share of tension, like the PTA meeting where a mother balked when she discovered her daughter's PE teacher was black, or the time a student asked him to clean up a classroom, thinking Crutch was a custodian.
He had never seen a black teacher. There wasn't very few black teachers in elementary school. All he see them is mopping the floor and doing all the custodial work.
Then there were the incidents he faced when he got his first gig as a varsity track and basketball coach at Sherwood High School. The referee who mysteriously disqualified one of his sprinters. The scoreboard that suddenly flipped, putting his basketball team behind. The road games where he'd be mistaken for an assistant coach, not the head one.
All right, so we go to the school. There's a lady sitting right there. She said, "That's $5, please." I said, "For what?" She said, "To go into the game." I said, "I'm the head coach." She said, "No, you're not. The head coaches went in, and they were white." I said, no. They are my assistants, and I'm the head coach, and I'm walking through, and I'm not paying, and you watch who's coaching that team.
It could be disheartening, he says, but...
You know, you're bigger than that, and you just keep fighting. Keep fighting.
And Warren Crutchfield definitely has. He's led teams to district, county, regional, and state championships. He's been named Coach of the Year, Teacher of the Year, even Citizen of the Year in Olney. He's in the Sherwood and UMD Eastern Shore Athletic Halls of Fame. He was even persuaded to come out of retirement to coach at the prestigious Sidwell Friends, where one of President Barack Obama's daughters ran on his track team. But it isn't his own accomplishments that have given Warren Crutchfield the most pride. It's those of his students, he says, many of whom stay in touch to this day.
You have doctors, you have lawyers, you have teachers, you know, entrepreneurs. I mean, they're doing everything.
Which shouldn't really come as a surprise, given the wisdom their teacher and coach was able to impart.
This is what I told them. Never say I can't. It is difficult, but I will try. It is difficult, but I'll try.
The Sidwell Friends School, where Warren Crutchfield coached Malia Obama, is on a leafy 17-acre campus off Wisconsin Avenue in northwest Washington. But since 1963, the elite private school also has had a separate campus in Bethesda for its elementary school kids. Sidwell recently announced the school is consolidating by purchasing 5.7 acres next to the main campus. But current residents of those 5.7 acres aren't too happy with the news. They're the men and women of Washington Home, a nursing facility for low-income seniors. And now some Sidwell alumni are also questioning the deal. Is the school living up to the Quaker values it tries to impart to students? Matthew Schwartz has the story.
The letter went out this September to all 6,000 living alumni of the Sidwell Friends School, celebrating what it called a historic opportunity to unify the campus. Judith Ingram is a member of the class of 1978.
We got this letter, and I found it disturbing. And sort of filed it away in my head that this doesn't sound right.
The letter said nothing about what would happen to the more than 100 current residents of the Washington Home.
I would expect more care, more concern from Sidwell. And I didn't see it in the letter.
The home planned to relocate residents to other facilities by the end of 2016. Sidwell Friends wouldn't be involved in the transfer. The Washington Home assured them it had it under control. But for Larry Ottinger, another member of the class of 78, the school should be taking a more hands-on approach.
That sense of inquiry and responsibility, that was one of the things that concerned the alumni who know about this.
A spirited discussion began among members of the class of 78. Was it okay for Sidwell to just assume that the Washington Home would be able to relocate the residents without looking into it themselves? Ottinger and 16 other alumni drafted a letter of their own.
What we wrote is that we believe that Sidwell has a moral responsibility and a reputational interest in proactively trying to make sure that the residents and families of the Washington Home would have the best transition possible.
Perhaps part of the $32.5 million Sidwell is spending to buy the home could be set aside to help the families transition, Ottinger says. Perhaps, as a Quaker institution, it has a greater than normal responsibility to help those in need. Here's Judith Ingram.
Being at Sidwell, you got a constant education in ethics. It's a reputation I think the school wears proudly. And I don't think, and my classmates, the ones who've signed this letter, agree that we're not showing our best Quaker face.
We have some entertainment here tonight.
Yes.
Ivan Mayfield is co-chair of the Washington Homes Family Council. Her mother has been there since 2009.
She has long-term dementia.
The dementia unit at Washington Home is a secured facility, one of only four in the city. It helps keep her mom from wandering away, as she's been known to do in the past.
So now that we're losing that, that only leaves three others.
That's three locked units in the district.
There aren't any spaces. So what happens then?
Residents at the Washington Home, most of whom are supported by Medicaid, have it pretty good facilities-wise. It's the only nursing home in the area entirely consisting of private rooms, many of which will become Sidwell classrooms and offices. Mayfield doesn't find that very moral.
You have some of the most wealthiest in the community against the poorest of the community. It's the same thing that keeps happening again, over and over and over. People at the top taken away from the people at the bottom, who are seniors, who cannot help themselves, who cannot be their own advocates, basically saying, find somewhere else to live, because you can't live here anymore.
Washington Home CEO Tim Cox sympathizes with the residents, whom he was legally bound not to tell about the deal until it went through. But as far as he's concerned, Sidwell acted in an exemplary manner.
A lot of these private deals settle in 90 to 120 days, you know, because they need it for another purpose.
That would have given the home only a few months to get everybody out.
So for us to be able to have 20 months, you know, ultimately really was such a wonderful gift and shows the care and the depth that they had for us and for our residents.
Sidwell has offered to help with the transition if the Washington Home needs it.
But, you know, this is our business. We know how to do this really well. A very competent team at the home. They know what they're doing to help transfer these people.
And Sidwell Friends officials say they had no reason not to trust that the Washington Home would take care of its residents. Katie Smith Sloan is on the school's board of trustees.
The board had deep and thoughtful conversations about this purchase, the implications for this purchase, over a period of several months, in which we took lots of views into consideration.
But most of their discussion focused on the implications for the school and the surrounding neighborhood, not whether this was best for the home's residents.
Well, the Washington Home assured us that there were plenty of opportunities for their residents to be placed elsewhere. So we took that on its face value.
But that sentiment, that it's incumbent on the Washington Home to take care of its own residents, that it's not Sidwell's responsibility, that doesn't sit well with everyone.
What is ethically permissible is not always what is ethically preferable.
Guy Aiken is an ethicist and historian of American Quakers at the University of Virginia.
It may be that it is ethically permissible for Sidwell Friends to say that this is the Washington Home's responsibility solely, but I think Quakers hold themselves to a different standard.
And given that Sidwell wants to pass those standards onto its students, they have an even greater obligation, Aiken says.
It's almost an obligation in this instance for Sidwell Friends to go above and beyond the bare minimum of ethical requirements.
It's hard to say what holding themselves to a higher standard might look like, Aiken says, but at the very least, he thinks the affected residents of Washington Home should have their voices heard and taken into account. But Chris Davies thinks we might be asking the wrong question. Davies is counsel for the school, an alumnus, and a parent of current students.
The cost per patient, the cost per resident right now at the Washington Home is extremely high.
The nursing home facilities cost over $20 million last year to care for 323 people. Their in-home hospice services cost $8 million to care for 1,000 people.
So one might ask exactly the opposite question. Is it ethical to put so many resources into caring for one person when the Washington Home might conclude that it can better leverage its resources by altering the manner and method with which it provides care?
But that sort of utilitarian calculation is contrary to Quaker values, says Ottinger, who signed on to the alumni letter.
The issue is the respect for the people, for individuals. You can't start saying, you know, well, we're going to help 100 people, so we're going to have 10 people who are collateral damaged. That is not the kind of approach or mindset that we'd be proud of.
Sidwell Friends expects to have all campus renovations complete by the start of the 2019 school year. I'm Matthew Schwartz.
What do you think? Is Sidwell Friends acting ethically? Should a religious institution be held to higher standards? Send us your thoughts. Our email is metro@wamu.org. You can also tweet us at WAMU Metro. Time for a break, but when we get back,
I would take this report card home to my parents and feel good about it.
Grading DC Schools Chancellor Kaya Henderson after 5 years on the job. That and more as Metro Connection continues on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU news coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson.
I'm Rebecca Shear. Welcome back to Metro Connection. It was 5 years ago this month that Michelle Rhee stepped down as Chancellor of D.C. Public Schools. During her three-year tenure, Rhee kick-started wide-reaching reforms of the city's troubled school system. But in the process, she made plenty of enemies. She closed neighborhood schools and went to war with the teachers' union. In one memorable moment, she pulled a bit of a Donald Trump.
I don't believe that you are going to be the leader who is going to take this school to in the direction that we need it to go in.
And fired a school principal on national television.
No, I'm terminating your principalship now.
When Rhee left, her deputy, Kaya Henderson, took over as chancellor. Since then, reform has continued at DCPS, so much so that the school system that once lost students to charters is slowly winning them back. Martin Ostermuhl recently sat down with Henderson to discuss her 5 years at the helm. He started with a simple question.
Is there any specific thing that you know now after 5 years that you wish you had known when you first took the job?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. Maybe I wish I knew it was going to take this long.
You could probably excuse Kaya Henderson for showing a degree of impatience. But here's a telling fact about the leadership of DC's public schools. She's now served longer than anyone over the last 25 years. And in a way, she's got decades of work to get done. And she's certainly not the only person who wants to see results fast.
As fast as we're going, and if you talk to people in education all across the country, they are astounded at how quickly we've made this progress. People around here are like, faster, faster, faster. This is hard work. If it was easy and quickly doable, somebody would have done it by now.
Henderson first came to DCPS in 2007, when Michelle Rhee took over. That was the same year the city dumped its elected school board and gave the mayor exclusive control of the schools.
When we got here in 2007, the district was in disarray. And I think we spent the first 3.5 years really putting some foundational building blocks in place just to make sure that the place ran okay and tried to address some deep-seated problems that needed big solutions.
But many of those big solutions were masked by Rhee's hard-charging approach to reform. In 2010, Rhee stepped down and Henderson moved up. She says she learned a valuable lesson from her years of working with Rhee.
In order to make lasting change, you have to work with the community to do it. And I think there was a lot of work that we did in the name of fast and urgent that we would have gotten a little further on if we had slowed down a little bit and involved more people. And so I've tried to work that a little differently.
She has been different, and it seems to be working. Enrollment is on the rise again, as are graduation rates. Test scores have inched up over the years. In a recent poll, 6 in 10 D.C. voters said the schools are better than they once were.
I think overall, I'm really proud of the work that we did. I would take this report card home to my parents and feel good about it.
But Henderson is quick to add,
we still have a lot more work to do.
I just don't think it's an overarching success story.
Peter McPherson lives on Capitol Hill, and his daughter attended and graduated from DCPS. He's battled with Henderson on many issues over the years. He concedes that under her leadership, students are generally doing better.
But you also have to look at the enormous demographic changes that have taken place in the city. I mean, you know, is that we're a city that's actually growing, that's you know, much wealthier than any time probably in the last half century. I think, you know, a lot of those test score gains can be attributed to simply demographic changes in the city.
A recent analysis of test scores by DC's chief financial officer backs up what McPherson says. While students have improved across the board, if you subtract demographic changes over the past decade, those gains in achievement are much smaller. McPherson says the inequity in DCPS can also be seen in which schools were modernized first and which ones get resources. His big pet peeve is school libraries.
They say that a good school library should have 20 titles per kid. Well, there are schools in DCPS that have 3 and 4 titles per kid.
McPherson says that part of the problem stems from mayoral control, which he says gives the chancellor so much power that she has become unaccountable to parents and students. But for Henderson, changing DCPS for the better can't happen without mayoral control.
We're able to move quickly and nimbly. We have the political will where 3 successive mayors have made heavy investments in DC public schools, and those things have paid off. And so I could not imagine doing this work under an elected school board.
And she probably won't have to. City officials don't want to end mayoral control. As for Henderson, she says she wants to stay chancellor until at least 2017. That would be her 10-year anniversary at DCPS. I'm Martin Ostermuhl.
Very happy to be here in Ward 4 in this, the first groundbreaking of the transformation of Walter Reed.
D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser earlier this week at the groundbreaking for a new $12 million fire station on Georgia Avenue. It's the first step in the 66-acre redevelopment of the former Walter Reed Army Medical Center. But before jumping into Walter Reed's future, workers are busy demolishing a relic of its past, a notorious building soon to make way for the new fire station. As Nahani Rouse tells us, Building 18 took on a symbolic meaning.
Crews in fluorescent vests throw metal doorframes and sheets of wallboard out of third-floor windows. Trucks haul away debris. This structure looks like an abandoned second-rate motel. It's Walter Reed's infamous Building 18, which once housed soldiers wounded in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One veteran who spent time at Walter Reed says soldiers should never have been living here.
Well, I think it should have been demolished a long time ago. It should have been demolished before they put service members in it.
That's Staff Sergeant John Daniel Shannon, who was at Walter Reed from 2004 to 2007. He's a decorated veteran of the Iraq War and served as a sniper with the 2nd Infantry Division. At the height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Walter Reed Army Medical Center was bursting at the seams.
It was very clear to me on many levels that we were not prepared for the number of wounded coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's why service members ended up in Building 18 to begin with.
There were amputees, soldiers with traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder. At the peak of the Iraq War, there were 900 soldiers on the campus, plus family members who came to help take care of them. Building 18 was part of the facility, but it was outside the gates, and it was decrepit. There was black mold on the walls and mice and cockroaches in rooms where soldiers with open wounds were staying.
Building 18, to me, represented a microcosm of what was going on the larger campus.
That's Washington Post reporter Dana Priest. She and reporter Ann Hull spent 4 months posing as friends of patients to gain access to Walter Reed. They won a Pulitzer Prize for their 2007 series, which opened with Building 18. The reporters described how a mountainous bureaucracy, lost paperwork, and insufficient social services kept soldiers languishing at Walter Reed, and Building 18 became the bricks and mortar symbol of that neglect.
So the whole thing just didn't make any sense that this building would exist in this place that the president had said delivered the best medical care in the world for returning soldiers.
The day after the Post story was published, a crew in hazmat suits arrived at Building 18 and slapped a fresh coat of paint over the mold. Public outrage also led to a congressional inquiry at which Dan Shannon and other soldiers testified. Building 18 was vacated. On the larger campus, soldiers were grouped into smaller, more intimate units. Eventually, Congress decided to pay certain family members who care for disabled veterans. Tori Shannon, Dan's wife, is now one of those caregivers. Back in 2004, she got the call that Dan had been wounded. At the time, the two were divorced, and Tory was living in Florida with their three young boys.
And they said that he just keeps asking, where are my boys, where are my boys? So I said, tell him I promise to be there when he gets there with his boys.
Dan was on his way to Walter Reed after emergency surgery in Baghdad. A bullet had shattered his skull during the fighting in Ramadi.
And after I got there, it was very evident that he needed assistance.
So she and the boys stayed and lived for 3 years in Dan's room on the Walter Reed campus. It was the beginning of a second try at marriage and a lifetime as Dan's primary caregiver. Now he is on permanent disability and needs round-the-clock care. The Department of Veterans Affairs pays Tory 75% of what a home health aide makes, but the hoops they have to jump through in the VA system are as maddening as at Walter Reed. But Dan maintains doctors at the medical center saved his life.
Walter Reed, I sincerely believe, conducted medical miracles on a daily basis.
But the bureaucracy in the administration nearly drove them both over the brink.
I just felt lost in a myriad of wounded veterans.
What is the association you have with it now? What's the importance of it for you now?
I never want to see that happen again.
Yeah.
So many people's lives were changed inside the walls of those buildings, Tory says. So they have mixed feelings about the site being redeveloped.
In one way, I think it's a great idea, but in other ways, I think it's just it just kind of erases the importance of what that facility has been or could have been.
Reporter Dana Priest sometimes passes by Building 18 just to remember.
Whenever I'm driving by, I feel like I have this little secret history that was very important to a particular period of time and symbolically could be important to every war we ever fight, and yet people drive by it like it was just a regular old crummy building.
So what are the lessons in these old walls? What should people remember when they're knocked down?
I guess I hope they remember that the military is really good at fighting wars, but maybe not everything else. It did have a problem and still has a problem caring for people who are injured because it's not really what they do the best. And there is always this problem, is this person a soldier first or are they a wounded human being first?
Dana Priest now teaches journalism at the University of Maryland and still reports for The Washington Post. Tory Shannon is writing a memoir. And Dan Shannon, whose service to country left him with a Purple Heart and a permanent disability, hopes all three of his sons one day decide to put on a uniform. I'm Nahani Rouse.
If you happened to read local publications like The Washington Post, The Washington Evening Star, or The Georgetowner in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, you probably saw illustrations by a woman named Lily Spandorf. You might even have spied Spandorf around town as she painted her surroundings, a city in the midst of rapid change, much of which is unrecognizable today. Lauren Landau brings us this look at Lily Spandorf's work as an artist, journalist, and chronicler of Washington, D.C.
It's easy to get distracted in attorney Mark Griffin's office, which could be a problem if you're being charged by the hour. This space is decorated with framed prints, paintings, photographs of D.C., an eclectic array of pens, and other quirky items.
Well, collectors are addicts. And I'm an addict.
That addiction led to him writing a book about one of his collections, more than 150 paintings, drawings, and sketches by artist Lily Spandorf.
They show Washington in warm, real colors as it existed but doesn't exist anymore. And it's very hard to even describe or evoke because the pictures that we have from that period are just flat, old, black and white pictures.
He also knew the artist personally.
Well, Lily managed to survive her entire life as an artist, and I can't tell you how unusual that is. And she did it in large part because she was a personality, and she sold herself very well.
If she had an opportunity to make a sale or promote her work, he says, she'd go for it.
Lily saw the first Christmas stamp, and she said, I can do that. So somehow she managed to get an interview with the Postmaster General, and she brought a painting with him of a Christmas tree, and she said, this is your second Christmas stamp. He said, done.
Spandorf's painting of the 1962 National Christmas Tree appeared on 2 billion 5-cent stamps. 20 years later, Griffin was walking to his office when he first met Spandorf. She was sitting with her easel at 11th and G, painting a row of buildings that were about to be torn down.
So I asked the next question, do you do this often? Oh, yes, she said. I have a whole collection of these paintings. These are paintings I don't sell, she said. I keep them at my studio, and I'm hopeful that someday somebody will do something with them.
As it turned out, Griffin was that somebody. If not for that fateful sidewalk introduction, Spandorf's paintings easily could have disappeared, like the buildings they depict.
A few days later, I showed up at her studio, and she painted on anything that she could get her hands on, because she didn't have a lot of money. And they were all stuffed in two of these storage shelves, and they were in terrible condition. She starts pulling them out, and I recognize most of them.
After buying several of her paintings, Griffin was eyeing the rest.
And then I said, would you be interested in selling the collection? If you would, I'll have it all restored, and I'll have it matted and framed so that it'll be around for a long time.
Some of the paintings from the Washington Nevermore collection are currently on view at the Albert H. Small Washingtoniana collection in the George Washington University Museum. Jane Freundel-Levy co-curated the exhibit with Cindy Yonke of the Historical Society of Washington, D.C.
Her style is quite recognizable once you see it, and she worked in watercolor and gouache with pen and ink.
The artist herself was also a recognizable presence on D.C. street corners.
She had a little cart and a chair, and she would just set up on the sidewalk, and, you know, no permits, no stopping traffic, no none of that. She would just sit down and start to paint something that appealed to her.
In the exhibit, a painting of DuPont Circle in 1970 is paired with a photo from last year.
And what you see in her painting is a building that was People's Drug, and today is CVS, and so it's quite recognizable. And there was another residential building next to it in Lily's painting, and in the picture of that today, that red brick residential building is gone. It's been replaced by a large high-rise office building.
She'd also document the demolition as it was happening. In one painting, the Capitol building is the backdrop to a small red brick building, the former office of the U.S. Botanic Garden.
As you can see in the painting, there's a bulldozer right next to it, and it was about to be torn down. And that's really pretty typical of her approach to capturing what's happening in the city. Sometimes the bulldozer was about to come, sometimes it's actually in the picture.
The exhibit also includes portraits, paintings of the White House, and a series of murals. Newspaper clippings and sketches showcase Spandorf's work as a journalist. In the early 1960s, she illustrated a series in the Washington Post about women and alcoholism.
It looks like she's lying on the bed. She has a bottle in one hand, a glass in the other hand, and in the background of the picture in the doorway are a man and two children, clearly her family, suffering from the fact that the mother is an alcoholic. And these things are very strong and very piercing.
Levy says Lily Spandorf's work has tremendous historical value, documenting the changing city. She also notes Spandorf's contribution as a woman journalist at a time when that wasn't an easy path. I'm Lauren Landau.
For The Record, the art of Lily Spandorf runs through summer 2016. In a minute, if Montgomery County gets rid of county-owned liquor stores, would prices go down?
You know, I don't want to get myself in trouble, but I will confess, occasionally I have purchased products in the district. I found the prices higher.
It's just ahead on Metro Connection, WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear. The Crassostrea virginica, also known as the eastern oyster, is indigenous to the Chesapeake Bay. It's what sustained the bay's native people for centuries, and the region's earliest European settlers once they arrived. But over the years, the tasty bivalve has been through some rough times, in large part because of that tastiness. And that's the subject of author Kate Livy's new book. Chesapeake Oysters, the Bay's foundation and future. Lauren Ober recently caught up with Livy at the Pearl Dive Oyster Palace in Northwest Washington to hear why these briny little mollusks are making a comeback.
I'm looking at the list here at Pearl Dive, and we have 8 varieties that appear to have come from the Chesapeake. So should we try some?
Absolutely.
All right. So I think we're ready to order, but I'm going to let Kate here, since she's the expert, order for us.
We'll do 6 Little Bitches, 6 Barren Islands, and 6 Old Black Salts. The thing is, it's most important to get a variety that are from different locations, because that's how you really compare and contrast between the flavors. If you think of each oyster as a sea capsule containing the essential aspects of its environment from wherever it is, if it grew, you know, in an oyster bar that's right near a marsh, it might taste green. Or if it grew at the bottom of the bay, right near the ocean, it's going to be like crunchy with salt. Oysters that are from northern on the bay, you're going to taste that the meat first. So typically they have a buttery consistency and flavor. So that's just the initial experience. And then you chew it up, and then other aspects of the flavor start to develop, coppery notes or the minerality of the oyster, you know, what has it ingested, that kind of thing. And then there's the finish.
What is it about oysters that you wanted to take a deeper dive into?
I think out of all the species that are in the bay, oysters have this interwoven history with the Chesapeake's people. Oysters were this really compelling catalyst for colonization, for the oyster boom of the 19th century, and this ongoing discussion today. I mean, oysters are a controversial topic, and also they encompass a lot of our fears about the future. What's happening with our environment? What can we control? Is there such thing as a sustainable fishery? So much is going on around the oyster, and I found all of these issues so fascinating.
Now, it seems like, from what you describe in the book, that there are kind of like 2 major declines in the oyster population in the Chesapeake Bay. How did they each start, and sort of what was the result of the declines?
So the first decline is really a result of overharvesting, and we're looking at just the ceaseless harvest of oysters in the 19th century between the 1860s and the 1880s to 1890s. People are harvesting oysters not just for the meats, but for the shell, and so they're grinding up the shell and putting it in fertilizer or chicken feed, you name it, and it's not just the oysters themselves that are being destroyed, it's also the reef structure, this, you know, source of biodiversity in the bay. And so in the 1890s to the turn of the century, there's new science that explores how oysters can be replenished. And maybe we could have continued with a sustainable wild fishery, except for the arrival of 2 oyster diseases. And so this traditional oystering fishery was just destroyed. And it was those diseases that were really the catalyst for environmental changes in the bay and also rethinking the Chesapeake stance on aquaculture.
So what is the state of oysters for consumption in the bay? What's that situation looking like?
There is still a wild fishery in the Chesapeake, which may surprise some people, but typically, wild oysters go mainly to the packing house market. So they're going to be shucked into those plastic containers that you see at Whole Foods or you see at the grocery store. But then there's a whole new side of the industry that's really exploded because of the work that was done with oysters to figure out, you know, what was going to be the solution to all these dead oysters in the Chesapeake. Out of scientific testing that was done at the end of the 20th century, the very beginning, obviously, the 21st in the 2000s, for the first time, people are figuring out, how do we do aquaculture here? And the idea is that it's farming very much like a land farm. You've got your crop, which is your oyster seed. You grow it in floats, and you maintain it the same way you would a crop. And what we're seeing is this explosion of oyster farms, which is the best thing ever. Oyster consumers in the Chesapeake, we are enjoying a renaissance.
So you ordered 3 kinds. You ordered the Barren Island from Maryland, the Little Bitches from Virginia, and the Old Black Salt, also from Virginia. Do you have a favorite?
They're all very different, but overall, they're all excellent. So choosing a favorite isn't because the other ones are bad. It's just because that's your preference.
That was Kate Livy, author of Chesapeake Oysters, The Bay's Foundation and Future, talking with Lauren Ober. The Pearl Dive Oyster Palace is among scores of eateries that have opened in the nation's capital over the past few years. D.C.'s restaurant scene is pretty much exploding right now. But up in Montgomery County, Maryland, residents aren't seeing as many new, buzzy eating establishments. Some people blame the county's unusual liquor laws, which date back to the end of Prohibition. These days, Montgomery is one of the few counties in the country to own and operate all liquor stores within its borders. But now, the county is seeing a new push to get rid of that system. Matt Bush asks whether that move would really benefit residents.
It's never been a secret that bars and restaurants dislike Montgomery County's liquor control status.
We're seeing the restaurant culture is migrating back into D.C.
Bill Frick represents Bethesda in the Maryland House of Delegates. His district is home to Montgomery County's largest area of restaurants.
Talk to the bartender, talk to the manager, talk to the chef. They don't get the kinds of products that they can get in District of Columbia. They'll tell you they don't get the speed of service.
Or talk to a restaurant owner like Chef Jose Andres. One of his four Haleo restaurants is in Bethesda. Unlike the other three, all the alcohol at the Bethesda restaurant must be purchased from Montgomery County. And Andres says that leads to situations like this.
If they don't deliver on time or the delivery is not accurate, I may be left out without wine or without liquor for that evening or that weekend.
Delegate Frick will introduce a bill during next year's General Assembly session that would put liquor control to voters via referendum next November. If okayed, private stores would be allowed to open and compete with the county ones.
Now is the time to seek a referendum, let our voters decide whether or not they want to continue with the county monopoly or whether it's time to open up our system to private wholesalers and private spirits retailers.
Frick argues opening up the market would also benefit county residents when they shop for alcohol.
On a regular basis, people tell me they simply buy alcohol in Northwest D.C. or they buy it in Virginia because they can get better deals, there are better stores, and all of this is driven by the unique Montgomery County system.
Montgomery County Council President George Leventhal, who supports the current system, counters with this.
Prices in Montgomery County-run liquor stores are very good. You know, I don't want to get myself in trouble, but I will confess occasionally I have purchased products in the district. I found the prices higher.
So who's correct? I did a little shopping and price checking, comparing the county's prices to five Northwest D.C. liquor stores near the county border, as well as those of Virginia's state-run ABC stores.
Okay, I'm standing outside the liquor store here on Hampden Lane.
I picked five liquors based on some pop culture references.
So we'll start with some Smirnoff vodka. That was originally 007's vodka in the first James Bond movies.
Even on sale, Smirnoff in Montgomery County was more expensive than in Virginia and at three of the five D.C. stores.
All right, the Kahlua we have in here is a $23.49.
As for Kahlua and Patron, it depends on the size the store offers, but both were cheaper in Montgomery County than Virginia.
Tanqueray also on special, $17.29, regularly $20.15. Canadian Club also the big handle, $14.99 on sale.
Both are cheaper in Montgomery County than anywhere else.
So everything I've picked so far is on sale. That is completely by coincidence, not on purpose.
While it's not totally clear who wins the price battle, County Council President George Leventhal says it is pretty clear how voters would decide the potential referendum. Liquor control would almost certainly lose.
The liquor industry would pour unlimited spending into a ballot referendum campaign.
Without liquor control, the county would lose up to $30 million in revenue. Delegate Bill Frick says that really isn't a lot.
$30 million? Out of a budget of $5 billion, I think we can, that's a problem we can solve.
Well, that's great. I hope he can suggest how to make up the difference.
Council President Leventhal warns a tax increase is likely if the county loses control of its stores.
I'm not falling on my sword to maintain county-owned liquor stores, but we've got to find a way to balance the budget.
Before voters can weigh in on liquor control's fate, Delegate Frick has to first convince at least half of the 32-member Montgomery County delegation to support his bill. Five are sponsoring it, so there's at least 11 to go. Getting that much support would put the bill on the fast track to approval by the full General Assembly. I'm Matt Bush.
you've heard of renting a room or a house on Airbnb or similar websites. But what if you could rent something else, a vintage Airstream trailer, and spend the night anywhere you want? Well, now you can. A local architect and Airstream aficionado recently launched a business restoring and renting out vintage trailers from the 1950s and early 1960s. John Hines has the story on the Nomad Mobile Motor Lodge.
There's a lot of work going on in Michael Vallon's warehouse, where he stores his collection of old, dare I say, vintage Airstream trailers.
1955 Airstream Overlander, another 1955 Airstream Overlander. This is a third Airstream Overlander, and this is a 1953 Airstream Liner, the biggest trailer they made in 1953.
Tools and pieces of trailers are scattered about. Vallon and his workers are polishing, scraping, hammering, sawing, and perhaps willing to life a 1961 Airstream Sovereign that he recently acquired. He explains that his love affair with Airstream trailers started when he studied their construction in architecture school.
I was fascinated with how they were made. And so I had the bug most of my adult life, but never actually acted on it until about 5 years ago when I bought a 1957 Caravanner.
Then, in the process of restoring his first trailer, with some professional help, he got hooked.
That led to me purchasing a number of other Airstreams and starting to work on them myself.
In January, he started his business, Nomad Mobile Motor Lodge. The idea is to rent them to people who want to spend the night in not just any old trailer, but a vintage Airstream, just about anywhere they would want. Vallon's business associate, Michael Wilkinson, explains the concept.
Well, there's a lot of different things that we can do with all these trailers. One is we can meet someone, set it up, get them set up at the location, and then leave them to have fun for the weekend and come back and take it away when they're done. And we can do that anywhere. We can do that in the Eastern Shore, in the mountains in West Virginia. We can even do it on a large enough piece of parking lot in DuPont Circle.
In September, Vallon started renting three of his fully restored vintage trailers through a new website that's sort of an Airbnb for RVs.
Yeah, I had talked with Airbnb about being the host sort of site for scheduling, reservations, and all that. And I was about to do that, and a new company came online nationally. I guess they'd been test marketing in California, called Outdoorsy.
Whether you rent a vintage Airstream trailer through Outdoorsy or not, the trailers are unmistakable. They look like big, shiny silver loaves of bread being towed down the highway. Wilkinson says they attract attention.
If you're at a rest stop, everybody comes up to you and is curious and wants to talk about the trailer and wants to see it. They are very sexy.
Vallon says that part of the appeal of the trailers he restores may be his attention to original period details and historical accuracy.
And I know that what I'm doing makes sense and works because I watch people's reactions really, really carefully. And it is hands down, every single time someone walks into one of these trailers, I get the same reaction. I could live in this. This is beautiful. These things are incredible. Look at, there's magazines from 1953. You know, on and on and on. It's just, I know it works. People love this stuff. They absolutely love it.
Why?
I don't have an answer. I just think it's human nature, a sort of a vague understanding of the past, based on their grandparents or some very much older person in a family, or maybe memories of times in childhood. It could be, it's a lot of different things, but there's something about this whole experience that makes people feel really, really good, and it puts them in a very happy place.
Around the country, there are thousands of Airstream aficionados and dozens of clubs devoted to the trailers. Gail Sundy is a member of the club, which includes the Washington, D.C. area. Sundy has owned her own vintage Airstream trailer for the past 20 years, and she recently acquired another.
That is a 1958 Flying Cloud. It's very 50s. Terribly 50s.
Sundy tries to describe the trailer's allure.
It's silver and it looks like a sunbeam toaster. I tend to like things that are unique. These are not your basic sort of slab-sided white trailers that seem to be everywhere in a campground. They have character. Every one of them that I've ever been in is different, and people love them. They're family members almost.
Meanwhile, back in his Maryland warehouse, Michael Vallon continues polishing and ratcheting his Airstream Sovereign trailer to life.
we're trying to do something sort of like a time capsule, capture a moment in time that you can go back and experience and enjoy and don't have to take care of it.
A moment in time for about the price of a downtown hotel room. Sounds like it might not be a bad deal. I'm John Hines.
And that's Metro Connection for this week. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, is from the album It Was Easy by Title Tracks and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. We list all our music at metroconnection.org, where you can link to our weekly podcast and to our Twitter and Facebook pages so we can stay in touch with you all week long. I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.